This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is iFanboy Booksplode, A Contract with God and Other Tenement Stories, a graphic novel.
I'm no millionaire, but I'm not the type to care, 'cause I've got a pocket full of dreams. It's my universe, even with an empty purse, 'cause I've got a pocket full of dreams.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Booksplode. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hey there.
And Ryan Haupt has wormed his way into the Booksplode.
It's my first Booksplode. I'm ready to splode all over everyone.
And we are talking about A Contract with God and Other Tenement Stories, a graphic novel by Will Eisner. What the book is called, it might depend on what version you have, but that's the
classic
title.
They know what we're talking about.
It should start with A Contract with God. You can probably go with that.
And this book was published in 1978 by the legendary Will Eisner, the man for whom they named the award. Spoilers, spoilers, spoilers for this old, old book. I say old, old book that came out after I was born.
Well, what does that say?
This book is credited with popularizing, not inventing, but popularizing the term graphic novel. That's how Eisner marketed it to publishers. Mm-hmm. His career was all about elevating the medium.
Yeah. And it should be known, like, this was very late in his career. I mean, he was doing comics in the 30s.
Yes. Yeah. He was a veteran. He was already financially well off. Like from all his work, and he owned some art companies, and this is something he just sort of did in his later career. It was like, fuck it, I really want to do this. And he wanted to popularize comics. He wanted to make them not seen as a lowbrow medium, and so one way he tried to do that was through this book, A Contract with God, Other Tenement Stories. Now it's a perennial. It's in the canon, the comic book canon. And I had never read it.
Never, huh?
Never read it.
Does your version have the Denny O'Neill introduction?
Does it?
Mine did, because as established, Josh and I read the same version.
I bring it up because...
No, well, Eisner wrote an introduction in my volume.
Yeah, it's a preface, actually, here. Anyway...
A preface. He wrote several prefaces.
Yes, he did. That was a thing.
This has every preface from every version.
Okay.
So I've got all the prefaces.
Same for mine. Mine goes up to March 2000 when this version was published.
All the prefaces.
I really enjoyed this preface, and I mean that to say that it put me in mind in a really helpful frame of mind to read it. And he actually says, which I think is really fascinating, is that the first time he read it, it didn't really connect with him. And mm-hmm. and he is a learned man of letters. You read this like he
Denny
writes
O'Neil.
Beautifully. Yeah, Denny O'Neil, and he spoke about it in such a way that really. Actually really affected how I thought about it, is he said, you know, when I first read it, I didn't get it. It didn't really make sense to me. He said, but, you know, later I had a different feeling about it. And he said that, you know, the idea is that a critic can only judge the intention of the artist and if they think that artist succeeded in their goal. And I was like, that is fascinating. And that stuck with me in the way that we would talk about it. But as I read this, I kept this in mind. And the reason that I bring it up is that when I first read this, you know, probably back in 2000, mm-hmm. it didn't make a huge impact on me. I don't think that I was in a place to appreciate or understand it in the way that I would later. And so when we reapproached it, I was really looking forward to, but also apprehensive. I was like, I hope I get more out of it than I did the last time. You know, and we were talking before, I'm 23, 24.
You were not in the right headspace for that.
Not even that, but like when I read it now, I could give this an A+ just based on hand lettering. I mean, like there is a level of craft that yeah. I did not understand at that point that this time, you know, every page had a thing on it where I was like, look at this master. Yeah. You should have an award named after you.
Yeah.
And so that on top of, you know, the social history that he'd done in here, you know, I know a lot more about the world and how it used to be now than I did then. And all of that contributed to a whole different experience for me this time. And I really appreciated that.
Well, it's interesting. You know, Eisner is on the Mount Rushmore of comics. And he's yeah. on there having done very little mainstream superhero work. You know, the stuff that most people in comics are known for. He did The Spirit. That was like his main thing he was known for before this book. But he worked early in the golden age of comics, and he didn't do Marvel and DC. He didn't do those kind of books. And so he exists almost in his like removed, exalted place because he didn't do the Fantastic Four.
But as a result, he doesn't really get mentioned in the same
right.
breath.
But as a result, my point is I haven't read a lot of stuff from him.
Sure.
Because yeah, we're so busy doing that other stuff. You know, The Spirit, I've read a little bit here and there, but for the most part, I know of Will Eisner through reputation and through a drawing here or a drawing there and from his hand-lettered name.
Yeah. Right.
And that's it. So this was one of the first full-length things of his I've ever read. And I'm glad we did this because that's a huge hole I shouldn't have in my comic reading life.
Same. It's sort of like watching The Godfather having grown up, you know, post that era where it's like, oh, everything is coming from this, in a sense. You know, like there's right. so much that... if you've read a lot of comics, you've absorbed a lot of what Will Eisner contributed to the comics landscape, to the comics language of storytelling. And then when you go back and read this, you're like, oh, well, this is clearly, like, this was the guy who did it. This is where it originated.
Let's jump in. This is what makes it so interesting, the book itself. It's four short stories, all set in and around 55 Dropsy Avenue of the Bronx, which is a fake address of a fake street in the Bronx based on the neighborhood that Eisner grew up in. As almost all these gods of the golden age of comics grew up in the Bronx or in the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
And if I may use this brief moment to Robert Moses this place up, there was a really really thriving middle-class Jewish neighborhood there. And there's tenements in poorer areas, but there was a real community and a huge place where people who had moved out from the slums of Lower Manhattan and sort of moved up to these more working class neighborhoods in the Bronx. And when yeah. Robert Moses put in the freeway system, he basically demolished all of it. So it doesn't exist now. So these areas that you're talking about are not there, or at least in any form like they used to be.
There's still a lot of tenements all over the place. The building I lived in Brooklyn for 10 years, it was a tenement at one point.
No, I know that, but what I'm saying is it would have been more like there was a huge like connected Jewish neighborhood, and then he bisected yeah. a lot of it. He bulldozed a ton of it. You know, he basically just cut it up into pieces. When I say he, I mean Robert Moses. But that's important for this history of the, like, it is this place that doesn't exist. You know, who knows what it would look like today? Would it be like Williamsburg or like other right. you know, more established ethnic communities if that hadn't happened? But that gave me a context like, oh wow, this is not only a world that doesn't exist just because time moved on, but like it's been wiped off the earth,
right?
Which is really interesting.
And so all these stories take place about the characters living in this building or around this building, the first one being a contract with God. That's the main lead story. It's such an interesting tone because the stories themselves are all pretty bleak mm-hmm. in one way or another, but they're told with almost a vaudevillian eye. You know, there's a lot of humor or absurdity in these bleak stories. And honestly, if you were a poor family living in a tenement in the Bronx, your life was probably pretty bleak. And you had to look at things with a vaudevillian eye. But there's a lot of tonal whiplash here.
Yes.
Not in a bad way, because, you know, life is like that.
That feels like very sort of, I hate to, you know, traditional Jewish humor. In yeah. that, like, shit's really bad. What are you going to do? You know, right. and there's a lot of that.
all the comedians that came out of that era, you know, were like that.
And that's what the dialogue in this sounds like, by the way. Exactly.
Right. Like I think another comparison that is obvious but important to note would be something like Fiddler on the Roof, right? Like it's very much the story of, you know, Jewish families and the struggles they're up against, but how do they find humor? How do they smile? How do they still talk to God in a loving and respectful way within that? It's fascinating framing.
Yeah, so, you know, the first story is about a man whose daughter dies, and he's mad with God because they had a contract.
And what that means is when he was a kid, he sort of made up a contract with God, and he said it out loud, and he's like, I'm going to do the right thing, and you take care of me. And then so when his daughter dies, he basically, you know, bellows up to the heavens, like, you broke this contract. And he turns into kind of an asshole. He makes a ton of money. He buys this building. He becomes a slumlord for a while. Yep. And then things change.
Yeah.
And I feel like that story is so essential to Judaism. I'm obviously not Jewish, but I've been to temple and I've been to my friend's bar and bat mitzvahs and all this other stuff. And I feel like the idea of, like, God is someone that you have an agreement with. And as long as you both honor and your end of the bargain, things will work out. And when God fails to honor his end of the bargain, then this guy gets really upset about it and changes his entire life based on it. It's really interesting.
Yeah. And then the second story is about the alleyway singers. These, you know, in the Depression, these guys who could sing would go into the alleys, the street singers, between the buildings, and they would sing, and people would toss them pennies, and that's how they would make some money to eat. And so this guy gets picked up by an over-the-hill opera singer who decides he's got a great voice, and I'm going to manage you, and also we're going to have sex, and it's going to get me back to the top. And then that doesn't go quite the way she thinks it's going to go. The third story was, they just got progressively rougher, was about the super. Superintendent of the building, who is the landlord's man on the ground. He's the guy that runs the building, keeps it in supposedly working order, and collects the rent and all that stuff. He's horrible.
I don't know that he's necessarily horrible. He comes off that way, and he's...
Well, he's a little racist. He's a little anti-Semitic.
This is a German guy in 1930-something.
Yeah. He's not great.
Right, but it does flip around completely in a way that is totally unexpected. And
he gets his life turned upside down in a horrible way. And then the final story is called Krukelin, which is about I didn't know anything about, with these farms when you couldn't afford to go to the Catskills. You know, that was a major summertime activity.
I was going
to
ask about this one because I had to, like, I was looking up words a lot in this one because this is the one where I was like, I don't know what this term means.
So you had all those Jewish resorts in the Catskills that families would go to in the summertime, you know, most famously portrayed in Dirty Dancing or Mrs. Maisel. But if you couldn't afford those, you went to these farms in the same area where the farmers would open up their land and they had built these sort of crude activities, you know, in the barns and stuff. But the families had to cook, and you sort of slept in these, you know, in the barns or in these, you know, rooms with lots of beds. It was like the poor man's resort.
Like family hostels.
But I imagine it was also a way to, like, get out of the city when it was really
hot. Well, that was the whole point, was to get the kids out of the city in the summertime. And so this is a series of characters who go to this one resort. Or this one crookleen place. Lots of things happen. Some of them good, some of them terrible. And so that's sort of the four stories. But the thing that really struck me about reading this was that, A, it's not told in a traditional comic book way. There's some pages that are recognizably comic book style in panels and panel-to-panel storytelling. But a lot of it's sort of single images or two images or three images on a page. Almost newspaper cartoon style.
Right.
What I loved about this was you could see the ink on the page. You know, you could almost imagine him dipping the pen in the inkwell and scratching the pages together. And I say scratching in the best possible way.
And it's printed on, I mean, I don't know about your copy, Connor, but this is printed on, you know, not quite white, at least not anymore, you know, uncoated kind of rougher paper, which is indicative of a newspaper sort of when you touch it. And it works. So, like, you can kind of run your fingers over it. And it would make you feel like this is a bit of the drawing, but it's pretty easy to open this up. And again, after talking about comics, you know, for 17 years now, not counting when we wrote about them at first, you know, every page I open up to has something where, you know, I wasn't kidding about the lettering, by the way. Like, I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, no.
The lettering in this is beautiful. But so even we take that aside, if I don't have anything to look at least I have the lettering. But pages, I don't know, for me, it's 10 and 11, and it's Frim Hirsch.
Yep.
Walking up to his house, and it's the rain is just drenching everything. And I don't know if I've ever seen better drenching rain drawn this way.
Right.
You know, the whole thing is, you know, if somebody did this in a comic book today that came out from Image or Marvel, you'd be like, wow, this art's amazing.
And look how minimalist it is. I assume you're looking at the page where it says, after all this, was the day Framie Hirsch buried Rachel, yes, his daughter. Look how tactile that is, but look how it's done such a minimalist style.
Like, yep.
The bricks are scribbles. Mm-hmm. The rain in the background is just lines, and you can see where they overlap, where he didn't go all the way down. And then the water on the ground, a lot of it is just negative space.
Yep.
It's so evocative of being caught out in a major drenching rainstorm in the city,
yeah,
and everything is flooding, and you're just soaked. It's beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, there's that stuff all through it. You know, how he's decided to light a scene. It's really that beautiful bit of cartooning where you have something that looks really beautiful and composed, and then you unfocus your eyes and, like, it's so loose.
Yeah.
It's so natural and loose, and it's comprised of all these little bits that don't look like they would add up to the final bit. You know who everybody is and what they're thinking and where they're coming from pretty much from looking at them. You know, it's cartoony caricature. It's not super subtle. There's nothing subtle about it.
No, it's vaudeville.
Ugh, it's just like it's all alive. And he really drew it in a way like, so this is 78. You know, let's say there he's 40 years out of the slums, 30,
right,
you know, whatever. And, you know, it's all very alive. You know, he's, I don't know if you can tell, he's clearly been there, but it doesn't look like, you know, he didn't go do research on what this looked like.
It feels lived in, for sure.
Oh, it feels like it's from deep in his memory, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he basically was 60 years old when he did this, which is crazy.
That's impressive. And, you know, when I read it, I thought, you know, I said, like, I know a lot more than I used to, but my wife's dad, he went and worked in the Catskills in the summer, you know,
right,
or great uncle and therefore grandfather, you know, like, they lived in a tenement in Astoria where they slept, you know, 12 of them in an apartment. It's not so far away. Like, I think if you read it now, you're like, oof, how did anybody, you know, and it's, you know, generation and a half back.
Yeah, it's the 30s. It's not that, it's not like 1830. No. But I think that's what's interesting about it is as a piece of historical reportage, too.
Mm-hmm.
You said it earlier, I think, Josh, you get a real sense of these people's lives in various ways. You know, you see their jobs, then a lot of them working in the garment factories and, you know, trying desperately to move up or just being lonely in your tenement and just desperate to find any kind of human connection. And as a look into the life in this block or on this street was really, if this is all from his memory, which is, you know, supposedly, you know, all just his sort of exaggerated memory of living in the Bronx, yeah, at the time. This
and
is,
the stories are tall tales to a certain, yeah, extent. Like
they're like fables.
They're just real enough, but, yeah, you know, they're embellished. But it's not that part that we're talking about in terms of realism, I think.
No.
It's the essence of all of those things.
And it's the details, too. You know, it's like, yeah, what were they wearing? What were they eating? What jobs did they have? What were their dreams? What were their hopes? What did their apartments look
slang,
like?
The slang.
Yeah.
The way that husbands and wives talk to each other, the way they talk about the obvious affairs that are happening, the way they talk about the kids and what to do with them. Like, it all felt, yeah, it was just so lived in and real.
The American story is this idea of upward mobility. And so that's sort of suffused in this whole thing. How are we, you know, how are we going to move ahead? And some people are like, why aren't you working harder? You know, and other people are trying to figure out a way to marry themselves out of it. Mm-hmm. And,
right.
But there's also sort of this little bit of like, oh, this isn't going to work. You know, like for most people.
It kind of showed that like that American myth of upward mobility, like it came with a higher cost than I think we often talk about.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And how that sort of struggle, like there's not, I'm trying to think if there's any good guys in here. You know what I mean? Like everybody is sort of, you know, if not,
it's all
sort
of very shades of gray.
Awful, very much. There's not like a hero. There's not, you know, oh, this person.
There's not a hero, but there's certainly people like the opera singer. She's fine. You know, she sees this guy with talent.
At the same time, but she's also still using it to try to get part of her youth back. You know,
yeah.
And there's not altruism necessarily. You know, even Frim. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
He turns into a monster.
He does turn into a monster, and then he kind of turns around and
for good reason, but he does.
Sure, and you know, but and then he kind of does the right thing, and he kind of has a he. I love that part of the story where he goes to the Council of Rabbis or whoever they are, and he's like, mm-hmm, "I want you to write this up. You know how to talk to God better than anybody, so you do it." And then he leaves, and they're all. I mean, you can hear the voices, and maybe they're sort of cartoonish voices, but it's like, we should not do this. Are you saying a man could not also be? And they're like, yes. And they consider it. And they do it. And they write it up because they can't see a way that it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
I really liked that.
I mean, you say there aren't any really heroes. In the fourth story, Cuculain, a lot happens. And it is very Dirty Dancing, which is,
it gets, you know, dark fast, though.
It gets dark fast. But it kind of hit me at the end of the story. And I don't know if you guys had this same thought. Like, Willie's supposed to be him. right? Like, he's Willie is Will
Probably.
Eisner.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I didn't catch that, but I don't think you're wrong.
It literally hit me on the last page when his mom is calling out. My page, last page being different than Connor's, yeah. When his mom is calling out to him when he's looking sort of sad and thoughtful out on the fire escape. And she's saying, like, hey, Willie, you know, summer's over. What are you going to do now? And he's, like, just kind of looking bummed about the world and the experience he had at the Cuculean over the summer. And I'm like, holy shit, this is him. That's Will Eisner in that drawing. Like, he's telling this story about himself.
That's excellent. The yeah. thing is, I think a lot of the stories are, I don't know, like I said, they're true, but also overwrought. But if I think about the facts of any of them,
they feel like tall tales. It's Paul Bunyan, you know. It's
yeah,
it's...
but if you think about what the facts are, like, so this guy goes out and he's gonna meet a woman, so he's acting like he's rich, and there's a woman who's trying to meet a man, so she's acting like a rich, and they end up together, and then some violent shit happens to her. I'm like, all of this stuff very likely could have happened. It feels far fetched, but it's not. Or the story of the superintendent, you know, who gets yep. it's that's like the set
honey trapped.
Yeah, by a kid, but she's like 10, so yeah. It's even like worse. You know, like he made that little girl evil.
Yeah,
they're not so far afield. Like when you read it, it's like, well, those are a little fantastic, and then you go, actually, you know, it's crazy shit happens in the city.
I think we as a people have probably rose-colored glasses about how civilized we are. You know, at this very moment,
sure.
But go back even into the 30s when things were bleak and there was no food and jobs and things get dark mm-hmm. real quick. Terms yes. of what you'll do for money or what you'll do for anything. So, yeah, I mean, I had no trouble believing elements of truth in all of these stories.
Sure.
Even if they are presented in a way that's slightly fantastical. Not yeah. fantastical.
There yeah. might have been stories that were told around the neighborhood that may or may not right. have been true. And you just shove them all together in this thing for this sort of harsh, truthful look at human nature
right.
at yeah. that time.
Well, and I think a theme that's been touched on off and on in our conversation is what desperation can drive people to.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, desperation is such a powerful force in these stories in making people
drive
do
you to
things.
Do anything.
Yeah, it makes people do things they know are stupid and they know is gonna come back to bite them, but they can't help it because they're desperate and they're hungry and they want more than what life has given them thus far. And so they push it and they push it to the limit, and sometimes when you push it to the limit, it breaks and things go bad and you have to deal with those consequences.
Let's talk for a bit about the form,
mm-hmm.
because this is, he said, you know, we're the first graphic novel or whichever it was. We're talking about 1978, you know, outside of the comics with an X,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some stuff towards, you know, adult mature stuff. And I don't even know when heavy metal came out, but the content is adult. There's sex and there's nudity in it. And it's funny because it's not, the nudity and sex in it is not particularly sexy. It's not.
No, very matter of fact.
It is, and it's very sort of realistic. Like, bodies are not perfect. They are,
they're,
you know,
human.
Cartoonishly realistic. How's yeah. that? And I just think this must have been so unheard of at the time. You know, that a comic.
Well, it was definitely Crumb and people like that doing things like this, but in a mainstream sense, yes. For sure.
But yeah, but like it's sort of a straightforward take. You know, like Crumb is Crumb and, you know, that's comics. That's part of that sort of underground comics thing and it kind of existed there. But sort of this kind of take on stuff, I don't know where else you would have seen this. You know, there wasn't going to be a movie necessarily, you know, with this kind of thing. Certainly not on TV. Maybe there were probably books or things like that. But the sort of visual depiction of it and putting in a comic... I mean, look at comics in 1978. It's
certainly,
it's crazy.
Comics, yeah. You know, it brings to mind it comes on the heels of, well, the very last gasp of sort of the movie revolution that is actually about to die because in 78 because of Star Wars and Jaws and things.
I think it had just died.
Yeah, so the more realistic, grittier films that were coming out in the 60s and early 70s, like Ryan said, like films like The Godfather, Bonnie and Clyde, things, you know.
Dog Day Afternoon. This yeah. felt, you know, it's like a very, like, sweaty.
Sidney Lumet kind of film.
This is
a
comic book version of, you know, what Scorsese did as Mean Streets.
Yeah.
I think of the 70s, especially in the, like, New York, the city as a character stories, as, like, everyone was just sweaty all the time. And this comic, even though I don't know there's a drop of sweat actually drawn on any character, it depicts that.
Spend a day in New York City in August, you'd be sweaty too. That's yeah. still a thing.
Sweaty and angry. Yeah, it feels like it's from that era. You know, it feels like the comic version of those kind of films. Mean Streets is a great analogy. So yeah, try to sell this to somebody buying Kurt Swan's Superman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very different. But you're right. I just keep looking through it. And Eisner, one of the many things he's famous for is his titles and how he incorporates the titles into the art itself. You know, that was the big thing about The Spirit, was the hand-drawn titles that would be part of the art. And while it's not quite as immersive here as The Spirit, it's very much, it's all on the page. It's all hand-drawn. It's all somewhat incorporated into what's going on in the page itself.
Which I think is the correct stylistic choice.
Yeah.
There's not a place for a giant, elegantly rendered, totally detailed title page in this one, but I don't think we have these anymore. Is a cartoonist who does everything. Everything. You know,
very little.
Like they used to be able to all, you know, like
Terry Moore
used to be able to draft, you know, letters that, you know, Chris Ware is the closest guy I can think of to what Will Eisner does, although it's
I think Connor makes a good point with Terry Moore. Like, I do think about Terry Moore's style in terms of inserting blocks of text in ways that, in if anyone else was doing it, it would be a wall that you were hitting while reading. But when
and also, I think just the stylistically, in terms of
you're actually not wrong.
The scratchiness of the black and white art on the page is very similar, even if their actual styles are not the same.
No, but you know, like visually. And sort of storytelling-wise, there's definitely connections.
Yeah.
Wish I had a chance to ask him about that, or wish I'd known that at the time.
Yeah, but it's very few. I mean, like, Cliff Chang's doing that in that Catwoman book. Well, he's doing everything, but...
Lonely City.
But does he hand-letter it?
No, but he's doing the lettering. He's doing all the stuff.
That's what I mean. Like, this stuff is hand-lettered. They had to learn to do that.
Right. You had to be able to do all that stuff back then.
Right. It's such a beautiful art.
You know, almost all these guys were fine artists who... did comics because, again, they were Jewish, and what else were they going to do? They weren't going to get hired to do advertising.
But a lot of them, I mean, you know, Kirby's is one of those where he just started doing it.
Yeah,
and
sure.
He had to get really
Eisner
good.
Wasn't.
And I don't know what Eisner's deal was. Like, I don't know that he went to art school or, Jesus, was there even art school? I don't know where he developed these skills, but the point is, like, he developed them, and you don't have to anymore. And so, you know, again, so when you do it, when you see this now, it's a specialty thing. You know, Chris Ware... you know, designs these pages that have the lettering and drafting all over them. You know, to be a mainstream comic book artist, you don't have to do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to. And, you know, there's a handmade aspect of that. Like, God, the lettering through this is gorgeous. It is all changes around in your size and your, I mean, like the bolding, but just the way it's all done is so analog. Like, it just stands out. I love looking at this whole thing and that sort of the complete package of the thing.
Eisner was a high school buddies with Bob Kane.
Yeah, I was just reading that too.
And they both went to the legendary DeWitt Clinton High School, which HBO made a documentary about because tons and tons of people you would know came out of that high school.
Yeah.
For some reason, like Robert Altman and James Baldwin, you know, just tons and tons of people. Bob Kane and Bill Eisner, obviously, too. But they went to school together. Burt Lancaster, Ralph Lauren, Stan Lee went there too. It was a very hotbed for comic books and you know, the golden age.
Well, it's funny because, you know, only more recently now would we look upon what they did. You know, at the time, those people going to comic books was considered a complete step down. So,
well, I mean, like the whole, you know, Stan Lee is not his given name. He was Stanley Lieber, and Stan Lee was a pen name so that he could go back to real literature. At some point later in his career, you know?
Which turns out that he never really wanted to do.
Well, his wife was...
He wanted to have done it. But that is a different show.
We already did that book split. Yeah, no, this was a joy. I mean, look, it could be a harrowing read, and people should know that.
As a read, it's actually quite breezy. It really...
Oh, sure.
No, it's over fast.
It's just shy of 200 pages. It's really smooth, easy reading. It's largely pages composed of big panels, you know, not
single
too many
images,
word balloons. It reads really well, which is should be no shock, but, you know, sometimes you feel like a book like this is going to be a homework book, and this is not a homework book.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I had no idea what to expect. Man, this high school, man, was a hotbed. Bill Finger went there, too. Like, this was...
Bill Finger and Bob Kane? What are the odds?
Bill Finger, Bob Kane, Stan Lee, Will Eisner. Think about that class. What were the cartoons like in that newspaper?
Probably Bat People and Spiritman.
Guys in domino masks and... Oh, boy. Anyway.
Well, Bob Kane wasn't doing any of the actual...
Yeah, he was paying Bill Finger to do it.
He just took credit for it.
And he signed his name.
The other person in this conversation for whom an award is named after...
The cartooning here, the character work, the expressions, Josh, you said earlier, you got a sense of everybody by their faces, their emotions on their faces.
How their clothes were drawn.
Their body language.
It's all of it.
It's a beautiful book. And I love the interstitial panels that are like all ink.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
don't know if those are the original. Sort of
the title, the chapter pages, I guess.
Yeah, they're all just very heavily inked. And, you know, this is a masterpiece.
Yep, absolutely. 5 stars.
Easily.
I just love that it didn't connect with me that first time, forever ago when I was a child. And I was really looking forward to connecting with it and hoping that it would, and it totally did. It met those expectations. And, you know, so many times you go back to something that is considered to be a masterpiece, and, you know, if it doesn't connect with you, it's always super disappointing. And when it does, that moment where you can read something and go, oh, okay, I understand why we're still talking about this 40 years later.
Yeah.
You know, and I love when you can see something universal and stuff. I mean, Connor, you watch a lot of classic movies and stuff, so I'm sure that's a thing that you're sort of looking for, is to be like, well, what, you know, because there's, you can enjoy the aesthetic of a given time, or you can try to find the thing that's common now where you say, oh, this holds up really well. You know, like, I always think of Stanley Kubrick's The Killing. You know, like, to me, it's exactly like Pulp Fiction. It is no less sophisticated or less interesting, you know, and I just think, oh, this was modern because that is, and this is both modern and of a different time. It was done 44 years ago. It was based on something 40 years before that. That's awesome. I just love that sort of time capsule. It's a time machine in a way.
Yeah, if you've got no idea what life was like in the 30s living in a Bronx tenement, this is a great book to learn, even if it's not exactly a nonfiction work. It's going to give you that feeling, the sense of life there.
And well, like this world that is depicted in it, again, like I said, this is 40 years before any of us were born. And he did this from when he was a kid, and he did it as an adult. And, you know, 20 years ago, I was on the floor at Comic-Con in San Diego, and I was next to the guy. I wasn't smart enough to know what that meant, other than I knew it was him.
Right.
I just love that time is much shorter than it appears to be. Like,
history is so much shorter than we actually think, because we only see what's right in front of us. Yeah.
And we're lucky. We're lucky to get to experience it.
Yeah, and we're lucky that we got to be on the tail end of being around the guys who created the industry and created the medium. You know, we've interviewed Joe Kubert and
Jerry Robinson.
And we've
Stanley.
I mean, interviewed Stanley many times. You were standing next to Eisner. Like, we got to be around physically those people, and people not just us, but anybody who went to conventions or anything.
I remember seeing Jerry Robinson at a con table, you know, within my lifetime, and I was like, I was too scared to talk to him, but I was like, holy shit,
I remember seeing him at cons, and no one's talking to him. No one. And it's just like, does anyone realize who that guy is? And the answer is usually no.
But yeah.
We could have talked to him for hours.
See the tiny apartment he's living in.
Yeah. I'm really glad we did this. This is all Ryan's doing. So Ryan, thank you for suggesting this, because I didn't even own this. I bought it for the show, and now I have it, so that's great. It's just one of those things you can just pick it up and open a page up, and there's something to really examine.
Yeah, it's a rich text, for sure.
The form and the medium and the story, too.
I appreciate you guys letting me hop on one of these. This was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
So we're going to do our, even though we already said it, our ratings on A Contract with God and Other Tenement Stories. Ratings.
I think I said 5, so I'm sticking with that.
5 all around?
Yeah, 5. I'd go 5.5 if you let me.
Well, speaking of sticking with it, I saw in the back, he also did Dropsy Avenue, The Neighborhood. Another graphic novel tracing the 4 centuries of Dropsy Avenue. I'm really curious about that.
When did that get made, I wonder?
I'm curious. And he also did one about Nazis. And like I said, I've never really read Eisner, so now I'm curious to see his other works. Life Force and Dropsy Avenue, The Neighborhood.
You're ready to check out the entire collection.
So Life Force is in 88.
So he was 70 when he did that one.
Yeah.
I think the character Willie in the last story really...
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. You're right, Ryan. Is that all you want us to say?
No, I was doing continued reading while we were chatting, and he's reading about how, like, when he was young, he was tall and of sturdy build, and, like, that's Willie, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, Willie had quite a time with the Crookaline.
Oh, that was what I wanted to ask you guys. After reading this, and there was another book. Oh, Aerosmith. After reading Aerosmith, do you guys want to sleep in a hayloft? I know Connor and I suffer from allergies.
I definitely would die if I did that.
I think with enough Claritin D, I could do it, and I think I would enjoy it.
I mean, conceptually, yes, but practically, I sneeze just reading the page.
In comics, every time a dude does it, someone else climbs up there and they get to have a good time. So, you know.
That's true.
There's opportunities.
Frequently, though, like in comics, about half the time, that's a demon or something.
Yes.
Something I mean.
Else. Also, hay is not soft.
You flip a coin.
Maybe it might be more. All right, well, this is a different show. So we will be back for the next book's blood, which we have talked about but have not fully nailed down. So we'll let you know when that's going to be. But as always, you can find our Booksplode shows and our sister show, the Talksplode show, where Josh interviews a creator. Well, that's where he interviewed Joe Kubert. You can find all those at ifanboy.com. And those are all unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy. Thanks to the patrons. We also do our weekly Pick of the Week show, in which Josh and I and sometimes Ryan talk about the week's comics. We have our special edition shows. We talk about movies and things. So all kinds of things happening at fanboy.com. Check those shows out there. And until next time, I am Connor.
That makes me Josh.
And I am the spirit of Ryan, but it's written like it's written on the text of the podcast. Ooh. So it looks like it was built in.
Sweet.
Oh, I'm no millionaire, but I'm not the type to care. 'Cause I've got a pocket full of dreams. It's my universe, even with an empty purse. 'Cause I've got a pocket full of dreams. I would take all the wealth of Wall Street for a road where nature tries. And I calculate that I am worth my weight in gold.